I'd like to call the Committee on Rules to order, and we are opening a public hearing, possible work session on HCR 35. Representative Whitsitt.
And members of the committee, HCR 35 honors teacher and coach Bobby Steininger of Lakeview, Oregon.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle and committee members. Today it's my privilege to bring to you House Concurrent Resolution 35, which is to honor Bobby Steininger, who has been a teacher, a coach, and a mentor for 50 years and has had a profound effect on the town of Lakeview. We all have pillars of our communities, and with this resolution, I hope to give the community of Lakeview a chance to thank Bobby for the positive role she has played in countless lives. A few things that Bobby's done. In 1980, she was Oregon's Track Coach of the Year and was runner-up for National Coach of the Year. In 1981, she was named Coach of the Year for all sports for 3A. In 1989, she was named Coach of the Year for track and all other sports for 2A. Bobby won the National High School Sectional Coach of the Year twice. She's been named Oregon's Women Coach of the Year for 1994 and 95. She was Lake County's first Educator of the Year in 2004, and she helped found Lakeview High School's Booster Club. The track at Lakeview is named the Steininger Track in recognition of her legacy, and this winter Bobby won the prestigious Game Changer Award at the Oregon Sports Awards Banquet. Numerous times, she's also won Cross Country and Track Coach of the Year for Lakeview District Sports, and in addition, in 1979, she started the Lakeview Disaster Unit. Bobby is truly selfless, and when it comes to her students and athletes, in just this past track season, she bought shoes for 8 of her athletes. Lakeview and Lake County is not really prosperous, and so Bobby's taken it upon herself to make sure that the students who run in track, she provides their equipment. She also uses her own personal funds to maintain Lakeview's track equipment. So I urge passage of this. She's a great person, and Lake County would really like to honor her, as Oregon should.
Thank you, Representative, for sharing that. Any comments from the committee? Okay,
thank you.
Thanks
so much.
So close the public hearing and open the work session on HCR 35. I'd entertain an amendment.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 35 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves HCR 35 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, motion passes. And the Representative Whitsitt, would you be the carrier? Thank you. Okay. So close the work session on HCR 35 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3537. And Representative Kennemer and Mr. Don Morgan, please join us.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3537 permits electors to simultaneously run as candidate for more than one district office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. Some of you may have seen in the newspaper an interesting situation that occurred in the last election in May in Clackamas County, where someone applied for some positions and was denied a position on the ballot. And it seemed like an appropriate thing to remedy with this measure. And rather than tell the whole story, I asked Don to come down, and Don Morgan's going to give his story. I think you'll find it interesting. I should note that in the May 21st election, just in Clackamas County, there were 13 water district seats that were not filled, 4 fire district seats, no school district seats, and 2 miscellaneous, for a total of 19 seats. So we're finding volunteers are in short supply, and we probably need to maximize those that are willing to do the additional work. So, please, let
Mr.
me
Morgan.
Introduce.
Morning. My name's Don Morgan, and I've served on the Canby Area Park and Recreation District as a one of the directors on that for 12 years, and my term was up this year, so I went down and got myself on the ballot again, and everything was fine. The last day you could register to be put on the ballot, I had a phone call from some friends. They wanted me to run for the Canby Fire Board. They needed someone from lives out in a rural district, and there was a seat open. Nobody had filed for it. And they finally talked me into doing it. Nobody else had filed. There was only like 4 hours left for anybody to do anything, so I went down and filed for that seat, too. And about a week later, the elections Clackamas Elections called and said that I could not run for two positions, and they asked me to please pick one or the other that I would prefer. I told them I'd need to make a couple phone calls because I'd committed to people, and I'd call them back in an hour or so, which I did. And in that meantime, they had checked with the state and found out that you couldn't just pick one or the other then, that they had to eliminate me from both positions, and nobody was going to run for either one then. So that kind of started the hullabaloo where my name got in the paper and such as that, and led to this.
Yeah. Madam Chair, just a couple other items. There should be a copy of two newspaper articles that in your record there that make it kind of helpful to understand that. State law says that if that you may not run for more than one non-remunerative office. And I don't see why we'd want to discourage volunteerism. We limited it specifically only to special districts. You'll hear from the special district's rep in a moment who supports the measure. You know, I think we don't want one person occupying five seats on the water board or whatever, but this would allow them to be on multiple boards, and as you can see, there is a problem throughout the state getting enough people to volunteer, so I think we want to encourage volunteerism. Also think, frankly, some of the publicity from this will maybe encourage some other people to do the right thing and volunteer.
Well, I'm sorry that Canby won't have your leadership in these positions, but thank you so much for bringing this up, and I hope that you consider running again.
Well, I actually got a write-in for one of the positions.
So. Oh, that's fantastic. So. Congratulations. All right, with that, we'll call up Hasina Squires with the Special Districts.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association is a nonprofit that represents approximately 950 special districts statewide, ranging from providing services of water, sewer, fire, parks and recreation, libraries. Our boards are typically governed by five-member volunteers. These are volunteer positions. The statute does allow certain entities to be reimbursed a maximum of no more than $50 per meeting. That's typically not the case. Boards, people just volunteer and choose to give their time to service. One of the key issues for Special Districts Association is recently adopting a new five-year strategic plan, and part of that plan is to encourage recruitment and retention of qualified board members. Typically, when you do get your May ballot, sometimes if you live in a rural area, you'll see very numerous vacancies and no one having filed for office, and we are working with our board to see how we can better recruit people to volunteer for these positions and serve, and we believe this bill would go a long way to at least allowing somebody who wants to overachieve like Mr. Morgan and volunteer for two boards that opportunity. So we fully support the bill and encourage its passage.
Fantastic. Any questions, comments from the committee? No, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Okay, we're going to close public hearing on House Bill 3537 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 145A. And we have Steve Trout and Jana Zeidlich.
Members of the committee.
Secretary of State.
Senate Bill 145 removes requirement that candidate, political committee, or petition committee provide notice to Secretary of State if discontinuing statement of organization and closing accounts. Revises requirement that certain electronically filed data be made available on internet to public free of charge. Removes liability of candidate's treasurer for default or violation that occurs in performance of certain duties. Requires Secretary of State to send notice of civil penalty for failure to file campaign finance statement only to candidate. Removes requirement for periodic examination and investigation of randomly selected campaign finance statements. Removes requirement to file statement of expenditure deficit. Requires political committee or petition committee that expects neither aggregate contributions nor aggregate expenditures to exceed $3,500 to file a certificate to that effect with Secretary of State. Removes requirement that candidate file statement or affidavit for contributions from out-of-state political committees upon request. And removes requirement that certain corporations file report regarding shareholders. This measure has a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact and comes to you from the House, the Senate floor with 27 aye votes.
Whoever wants to start.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director. Thanks for the opportunity here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 145, which is our campaign finance housekeeping bill, hence the long introduction by Ms. Seiler. I will give you the highlights and then be happy to answer any specific questions you have. First off, in Section 2, this bill removes it places all responsibility for campaign finance violations on the candidate. Currently, it's jointly held between the candidate and the treasurer, and so this will put the responsibility solely on the candidate. We've had situations where the candidate wants to pay the fine and move on, and the treasurer wants to go to hearing and drag things out, and so we felt it's appropriate to put that responsibility on the candidate, and then they can be responsible for their relationships with their treasurers. In Section 4, it simplifies the process for discontinuing a political committee. It removes some extra steps that really didn't provide any real assistance, and we're trying to make this process as easy as possible. In Section 6, it removes the language for statewide and legislative committees to report contributions between January 1 and signing day of the legislative session. Now that we have ORSTAR, those reports are already required, and so this is not necessary anymore. So again, cleanup language. Section 7 increases the trigger, the threshold for when you have to file from $3,000 to $3,500, and this is solely due to the increase in fees for voters pamphlet. So we want to make it available for people to be able to file their nomination papers and to get a statement in the voters pamphlet without having to cross that threshold. And so that's the necessity for that increase. Section 9 eliminates the spot check requirements. So that's something that most people are excited about and will help us to be more efficient and not have the extra steps of those spot checks. Section 14 allows petition committees to be reimbursed for amounts received as contributions that exceed the amount to defray expenditures on loans. Section 17 removes three sections that have not been used or implemented in over 22 years. And again, as part of our cleanup process, we're moving to take care of those things, most of which would be covered by other areas that would already require reporting because those committees would need to file as political committees. So those are the highlights. Any questions in particular to any of these sections?
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 9, if I recall, you indicated that you were removing the spot check requirement. Does that mean you're going to check all the transactions?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, no. So we're just removing those extra spot checks that would happen at random, and we would no longer do those.
Well, if I could follow up.
Yes.
How are you going to figure out whether people are complying with the rules or not? if you don't do some kind of checks. Or are you, there's a check somewhere else that I don't know about.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, through the Orastar system, the system manages and updates all of those. So it will tell us if a transaction was filed too late, if it wasn't, if it was the wrong amount, or if it doesn't match. So all of those are reviewed through the Orastar system.
All right. It's automatic. And the last follow-up then. So all the spot check did for you was to determine whether transactions were internally consistent. It didn't help you with comparison against the real world to figure out whether any of these transactions actually occurred or not.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes.
Representative Hicks,
thank
did you.
You
have a...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep.
Section 2 on page 5.
Okay.
Line 10 and 11, a candidate may serve as the candidate's own treasurer or may appoint and certify to the filing officer the name and address of the treasurer. So that's being deleted, but I don't see language in there to the effect that a candidate may serve as a candidate's own treasurer. So is that covered somewhere?
Members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick, Legislative Director for Secretary of State. Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, yes, it was verbatim, it is contained in another statute. I think it is 035, if I'm remembering correctly, but I may not be, but yes.
Okay.
So the requirements.
Any other questions, comments? All right, thank you so much. And Dan Meek. Mr. Meek, please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Dan Meek. I'm testifying here today on behalf of the Oregon Progressive Party and the Independent Party of Oregon. We oppose one part in particular of Senate Bill 145A, and that is the repealing of ORS Section 260.049. Currently, if organizers form a corporation primarily to support or oppose candidates, measures, and or political parties, and it provides funds for a political contribution or expenditure, the sources of that corporation's money must be disclosed under ORS 260.049 within 7 calendar days, including the names, the quote, names, addresses, and occupations of its shareholders, and the amount of paid-in capital attributable to each shareholder. That law is probably why, in Oregon, these types of political corporations appear not to exist, because there are stringent requirements about disclosure of where their sources of money come from. When you form this kind of a corporation, it is a for-profit corporation, and the money that goes into it, instead of being called contributions, and it's not a contribution, it's called paid-in capital. That's where the money comes from. If this law is repealed, however, organizers can form any number of ostensibly for-profit corporations, fund them to an unlimited degree with paid-in capital from individuals or other entities, and never report the sources of the paid-in capital. Instead, the most that they would be required to report is if they use this money then to make contributions or expenditures, they would simply report them in the name of the corporation. And that could be the Good Things for Oregon Corporation, the Freedom for All Corporation, etc. And you will never find out where the money actually came from. And the money could come from any source, any individual, any corporation, any foreign corporation, the Red Chinese Army, etc. So I think this part of the bill will punch a huge loophole in campaign finance reporting in Oregon. And to me, it doesn't make sense to open a new loophole simply because the law has been effective. That seems to be the rationale here. Well, no one has ever reported under this law. Well, that's right. That's because the law is effective. If you remove the law, you open the loophole for the creation of these political corporations to make unlimited contributions and expenditures from unknown sources and with no mechanism to find out where the money came from. Thank you.
Questions, comments, Representative Hicks?
Did you bring this up in the Senate?
Yes, absolutely. I filed written testimony in the Senate. I filed written testimony here yesterday or the day before.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Hicks, have you seen this kind of entity formed in other states? Do you have evidence that this does happen without a statutory disclosure?
Yes, I mean, it is a...
A specific example, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. A specific example is, you can look on the national... Oh, Representative Berger, Madam Chair, you can look at the national example of 501c4 organizations that have been formed since the Citizens United decision of the United States Supreme Court. Now, those are nonprofit entities, but they are not required to disclose their funders.
And but under current law, aren't they allowed to do that in Oregon, too? I mean, that doesn't change because of this. They can still do that in Oregon.
In Oregon, the sources of I'd have to go. I'd have to look into that.
I believe that's the case. Mm-hmm. I think you and I would agree on 501c4s and their use of funds in the political arena. I think you and I would agree on our objection to this, but I don't know that this law changes what we both object to.
Well, it opens a new loophole for for-profit corporations that are not even required to file federal 990s and are not required because 501c4s are eventually required to disclose their funders.
Under 990, yeah, I understand.
This loophole would allow corporations that are never required to report their funders.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Barnhart,
That dealt with my issue. I would suggest that we ask the Secretary of State why it's okay to repeal this, and if we don't get a good answer, we ought to amend this bill and get that section out of there.
Which one of you would like to come up and address that issue? Either one. Or both. Whatever you'd like.
Madam Chair, while they're coming up, actually, I had a question, Mr. Meek, too.
Oh, great.
Representative Berger actually anticipated. So just to follow up on her question, Mr. Meek, are there any other states in which there are these corporations that have been formed for this purpose? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay, because I'm wondering if, I mean, you would assume that there are not, you're supposing that there are not any such corporations here because we have language preventing it. I think we would have to look to the other states to see, presumably if other states don't have this kind of prohibition, we would expect to find these corporations in other states, if your reasoning holds true.
Yes, Representative Denbrough, if indeed other states allow the formation and operation of corporations who use paid-in capital to make contributions or expenditures and don't require that those corporations report the sources of paid-in capital.
Okay. If you could find some evidence for that, that would be great. Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name's Gina Zudlick, again, from the Secretary of State's office. The reason we feel like we can repeal this is because we think that any corporation that functions that way would have to file as a political action committee, and therefore would be covered under the law. We think they're already covered by definition.
Representative Hicks.
Covered under which law?
Under the definition of political committee in Oregon law.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, I'm sorry, Steve Trout, State Election Director. So that would be in ORS 260.007 in sub 16 defines person means any individual, corporation, limited liability company, and so on. And then in section 18, political committee means a combination of two or more individuals or a person other than an individual that has received a contribution for the purpose of supporting or opposing a candidate, measure, or political party. So, any corporation that is pursuing those functions should report as a PAC, and then we'd be able to track.
May I respond? I'd welcome it.
Yes, you can make a comment, certainly.
That defines a political committee as an entity that receives a contribution. Paid in capital is not a contribution. Paid in capital is what stockholders provide to a corporation in order to own the corporation. It's not some other person or entity making a contribution. So I don't believe it is included under the definition of contribution.
Mr. Trout, do you believe it? How do you respond to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, when you look at the whole of Section 18, we believe that they would need to file as a PAC and need to report.
All right. Any other questions or concerns? Representative Barnhart.
Madam Chair, I'm still very concerned about this issue. I'm not ready to pass a bill like this without further assurances that this statute actually isn't needed.
All right. Yes, Representative Jensen.
I concur with Representative Barnhart. It's just one of those days when the stars don't line up, I think. But I at minimum sort of thing would like to ask for a healthy opinion.
Yeah.
That
yes.
seems fair.
I can yes.
yes. Seems reasonable. We'll get an LC opinion, and we will revisit this issue on a different day. Thank you very much. All right. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 145 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 146 and... Same two people.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 146 revises and realigns statutory language relating to qualification and maintenance of minor political party, revises requirement for maintenance of minor political party to include candidate polling at least 1% of total votes cast in an electoral district at least once in a four-year period. This measure comes to you from the Senate floor with 30 aye votes, and there is no revenue, no fiscal impact on the measure as amended.
Mr. Trout.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Elections Director. We're here for Senate Bill 146, which is really trying to clarify and make it easier to understand how a minor political party maintains its party status. There was some confusion last year, and so we're trying to clarify that. Really, the only substantive change in this bill is to change from the current process where a candidate for a minor political party has to achieve at least 1% of the vote in an election every 2 years. And this extends that to every 4 years. So, for example, if you had a minor political party with a candidate for attorney general and they got 1% in 2008, but in 2010 they didn't have any candidates and attorney general's not on the ballot because it's only a two-year cycle, then that would threaten their ability to maintain their party status. Whereas with this bill, it extends it to a four-year term so that someone that's running for attorney general 2008 that then runs again in 2012, they would be able to maintain their party status during that period by achieving that 1% vote for that one office. So we think that that clarifies it and makes it easier for the minor political parties to understand what they need to do to maintain their minor party status.
Any questions or comments, Representative Hicks?
And does this implicate the nominating process of the minor political parties?
Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, no.
Okay.
Anyone else?
I mean, sorry.
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, I ask and I get, no, it's page 3, line 32. It says, it sort of talks about the nominating process, but it doesn't sound like anything substantive is going on there. That's just a Scrivener's kind of thing. Okay.
So.
Any other questions or comments on this particular bill? Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 146A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 147. And just for the committee to know, we're going to save our votes on any work sessions till the end and just go through the public hearings right now. And our all-star panel.
And members of the committee, Senate Bill 146 specifies time frame for filing candidate portrait and statement in voter's pamphlet and specifies deadline for filing signatures in lieu of voter's pamphlet statement fees, modifies placement of disclaimers to be included in voter's pamphlet, revises language pertaining to withdrawal of material for pamphlet, requires statements and arguments to be filed electronically with Secretary of State, expressly provides rulemaking authority to Secretary of State for purposes of verification of active elector signatures on petition filed in lieu of payment of voters' pamphlet statements. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. This measure comes from the Senate with 24 aye votes, 4 noes, and 2 excused.
Madam Chair, Members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Elections Director, and I think Ms. Seiler meant to say Senate Bill 147.
I did.
But it's easy to, especially with these in order. So this bill really has three main parts. The first, in Section 1, it sets a not sooner than date for people to make filings to us of 120 days. Currently, there's no start date. And what we found is every legislative session, there are changes to ORSAR and OCVR that we need to implement. And so in order for us to plan and be able to get all of our work done before people start filing under the new rules, we wanted to put a hard start date so that we could plan how much time we have to get our systems updated, and we wouldn't risk people coming in and filing while we were in process of updating those systems. So that's really the only purpose for that not sooner than the 120th day. The next major provision of this bill is that it requires all portraits and voters pamphlet statements to be filed electronically in ORSTAR. The real value in this is that we get more consistency. There's built-in checks with respect to word count and other functionality there, and it allows for more uniformity and reduces the opportunity for error as we would manually input those and lay them out for the voters pamphlet. And then finally, in sections in Section 4, currently in the voters pamphlet, we're required to print a disclaimer under every single argument, and so it takes up a lot of space and a lot of ink at the bottom of every single column, so usually four columns in the voters pamphlet, that the above information has not been verified for accuracy by the Secretary of State. We feel like that's way redundant, and are proposing to just include that in the overview in the beginning, to put those disclaimers to cover the entire pamphlet. So that's the gist of 147, and be happy to answer any questions.
Again, I know.
No, it's great.
So page 2, lines 10 and 11, all portraits must be filed and statements must be filed electronically. So really, all must be filed electronically. You're not going to accept over-the-counter submissions anymore?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, correct. Although every county has public terminals that they can enter that information at the county office.
Representative Barn, oh, sorry,
no,
Representative Hicks,
yeah,
follow up.
Let him go ahead.
So, if I may, it's kind of a strange. You require a black and white photo, right? I think.
Yes.
And so the candidate has to come up with a black and white photo, even if it's started in color. Are you going to change that?
Madam Chair, Representatives, we are looking at that and the rules associated with that. Given the proliferation of digital cameras and much better functionality now than we had 5 or 6 years ago when we initially started to do that, so that is on our list. We handle that by rule.
I got to air a pet peeve.
Wonderful, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The method of entering material, I'm doing this from memory, and you may have updated since then, but my recollection is that it's pretty clumsy, and that I can't simply give you a file that I've prepared on my word processor. I have to somehow or another figure out how to take the pieces of my filing apart from my word processor and enter them into little blocks in your system. Of course, that's not in the statute anywhere. That's something that you've done in order to do the. I find that very clumsy and fraught with possibilities for error on my end. Do you have any plans to make that easier to use?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, thank you. We're always trying to improve that interface and to make that as easy as possible. And again, with those built-in checks so that you don't end up being over word count and that we don't have font issues and spacing issues. And so, you know, we continually strive to try and, you know, make that as simple as possible for those specific blocks of information that you're asked to provide for the voters pamphlet information.
Thank you. Madam
yep.
Chair, I would simply add that I find it very convenient otherwise, other than the interface being clumsy, to file electronically rather than trying to do the old method and then wonder if the typist was going to get it right.
And if not, Chair. Oh, sorry. Yes. Sorry. Yeah, I have another one. But.
Okay.
Page 3, lines 28 through 30, the Secretary of State shall establish by rule procedures for verifying whether a petition submitted under the subsection contains the required number of signatures of active electors. What, if anything, does that language change? And there's comparable language on page 4, lines 38 and 39.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hicks, that language is elsewhere in statute, so this is conforming to just make all the statutes the same. It has no
substantive
effect, yeah.
Anyone else? Oh, Representative Dembro. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just while we're putting pet peeves on the record.
Don't get me started.
I've already expressed this to the witnesses, but I'd just like to put on the record, now that everything, assuming that this legislation passes, now that everything will be electronic, I think that it perhaps could allow us to move the deadline a little later. For filing, so that there'd be a little more time between the closing of the filing deadline and the submission of the voters pamphlet material, because I know a lot of organizations that do endorsements like to wait until after the filing deadline to see everyone that has filed. This is, I'm thinking of the primary particularly, and so this would allow, more than a week, which I think is what it currently is, something like that. Give it a few weeks. And it seems that with everything coming in electronically, that should really speed up the process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Dembro, as we discussed, as we continue to streamline and use technology to gain more efficiencies, we continue to look at those deadlines to make sure that they're not artificial and that we can provide as much time, given the hard printing and proofing deadlines that we have, to make sure that the ballots and the voters' pamphlet go out on time.
Since we're talking about pet peeves, what I will say is electronic filing is absolutely, I like it, it's efficient right up until the system seizes up.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
For those people, not that anyone here would do that, that leaves that to the last minute, if it seizes up and you pop and end up, we had a couple of candidates in Lane County that started on time, the system seized up because so many people were online at the same time, and they ended up not getting things in on time. And again, probably should have started days earlier, but it would be nice if that didn't happen.
Madam Chair, I agree, and to my knowledge, it wasn't our system that locked up, but as I've told other people, the similar analogy is when we're in the paper world and you have to get to the county clerk's office to file them, and there's a traffic jam that you don't anticipate, and end up missing the deadline. We have that in the paper in the non-electronic world as well. So to not procrastinate.
No, that is absolutely the message, and that's the message I give to candidates. But when you get popped out of the system and you have to refile and start everything over again, that has happened to me. But you do an amazing job, and I do think it's very efficient. So thank you so much. And anyone else? Any other pet peeves that we want to mention? Okay, with
got
that.
Got plenty, but I'm
close the public hearing on Senate Bill 147 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 148. And again, if you would like to start, and then we'll have Kathy Eaton come up afterwards.
And members of the committee, Senate Bill 148 requires chief petitioner to ensure criminal records check is conducted for pay, signature, gather, applicant, allows either chief petitioner or applicant to conduct check, requires one criminal records check per biennial general election period, allows agent of chief petitioner to submit signatures on initiative petition to Secretary of State on a monthly basis, gives Secretary of State rulemaking authority to determine scope of records check, limits keeping of accounts response to statewide initiative or referendum petitions, allows district attorney or city attorney to correct clerical error in ballot title for county or city measure, defines clerical error, creates whistleblower protection for person paid to obtain signatures on petition for initiative, referendum, recall, or prospective petition for state measure to be initiated if person reports violation of state or federal election law, rule, or regulation. There is an emergency clause on the measure. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. This comes to you with 18 aye votes, 11 noes, and one excuse from the Senate.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director. Let me just give you a little background on the main push of this bill, which is to require chief petitioners to have those criminal background checks done by their petitioners instead of us. What we find usually in the summer of the even-numbered year as we get closer and closer to the deadline are hundreds of petition circulators being submitted to our office to register, and then we are required to do a background check. What we find is happening in many instances, especially at the end of the cycle, is that they will just send people to register and have us do the background checks, but they never actually hire these people or have them go out and work. And so all of that work on our part is for naught. We have a five-day statutory requirement to turn these around in, and when you're getting hundreds a day, that was very difficult when I had one investigator to do that, given budget situations the last in this biennium. I no longer have that investigator position to be able to conduct these background checks, and so we thought that it would streamline the process and simplify the process to have the chief petitioner make sure that their petitioners perform those background checks to standards that we would put forward. Other sections in the bill, we added to make sure that these background checks only have to happen once per two-year cycle. So if you're going to go out and circulate three or four initiative petitions here in the coming session, you won't need to do a background check and submit that and pay to have that happen for each of those. One background check will suffice for all petitions that you would want to circulate during that two-year period. We also want to help the chief petitioners. Currently, the chief petitioners have to physically come in and turn in those petitions. We believe that they should be able to have an agent do that. And so this bill allows the chief petitioner to assign an agent to be able to take care of those filing functions for them. And then we have two sections regarding clerical errors in ballot titles that allows the district attorney or the city attorney in a clerical error to correct that without having to go to court before, in those tight deadlines, before those voters' pamphlets are printed and that information is printed. Just allows them to make easy clerical errors, corrections that won't require going to court and threatening the timelines of the printings. Gina looks like she wants to say something, and it makes it the same as we have at the state level.
Perfect.
Okay, and then in section 5 in ORS 260.262. Currently, it says any contract entered into by a chief petitioner of an initiative or referendum petition, but it doesn't restrict it to state petitions, which was always the intent and which is what we have authority over. And so this just clarifies that to make sure that it's only for state measures. And then in section 7, there are whistleblower protections added to assist in giving some protection to those people that are out circulating petitions or involved in the process in any way, to be able to have protections from them in reporting to us any election violations that they would observe. So those are the highlights of the bill. And again, happy to entertain any questions and maybe even some pet peeves.
Representative Hicks.
Okay, thank you. Page 5, lines 29 to 36, section 3. Regarding the ballot title certification, so you have the DA doing it, Is that because not every county has an attorney? How did we get to that point where we have the DA doing it?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, that the district attorney is the one that would have authority to write those.
Already?
It mimics the state. The AG does at the state level, the Attorney General.
Okay.
That's already in law, yeah. They write, the DA writes the ballot title for a city measure.
The DA writes the ballot title for a city measure already.
County measure.
County measure, excuse me.
For a county measure.
Yes, yeah.
Thanks.
Any other questions or concerns? Representative Holby.
I'm sort of curious on the criminal background check piece. So what kind of criminal history would disqualify someone, or is that going to be established in rule?
Go ahead.
Members of the committee, Representative Holby, there are three types backgrounds that we look for. It's fraud, forgery, or ID theft. And that's in law.
Okay. It's in the bill, too?
No, it's not new law. It's current,
current law.
Current law. Okay, great.
All right. Thank you so much. And with that, Cap Yeaton.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. If you could identify yourself.
Members of the committee, Chair Hoyle. For the record, my name is Kappa Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. You know who the league is and what it does, so I'm not going to go into that. However, I do want to remind you that the league is very supportive of legislation which protects the direct democracy process, simplifies and enables improved voter participation, and provides transparency and accountability regarding initiative petitions. I'm prepared to talk to 148, 149, and 154, so if I could just stay up here in between, that would be great. House Bill 148 deals with the integrity of the signature gatherers during the initiative measure campaigns. By requiring the chief petitioners to ensure that the criminal background checks are conducted for all personnel involved, that is a direct responsibility for the accountability of the campaign, which we think rightly belongs with the chief petitioner rather than necessarily with the Secretary of State. So we think this is a good change. Also, the ability to correct clerical error improves the whole election process because there's always a question if there's a misspelling or whatever. It could be a comma, it could be a question mark or whatever that needed to be clarified in terms of who could make those corrections. And the third piece of the bill that protects the petition passers who report election law violations, we believe is critical to keeping fraud out of the system, because if there is a worker who sees that another worker is actually doing the system in, if you will, that should be able to be reported without ramifications for the other person. And we feel that would also encourage reporting of possible fraud. So we support this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 148. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 149. Kathy, you can stay there. We have Gina and Steve. Please.
And members of the committee, Senate Bill 149 revises statutory provisions relating to ballots to align terminology with current vote-by-mail practice, replaces long-term absent terminology with specific reference to military or overseas electors, repeals certain statutory provisions rendered obsolete by vote-by-mail system, specifies the provisions apply to ballots for elections held on or after effective date, declares emergency effect upon passage, no revenue, no fiscal impact on the measure, comes to you with 23 ayes and 5 noes, with 2 members excused on the Senate.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Elections Director, here on Senate Bill 149, and there really is no policy change involved in this bill at all. It is, as Ms. Seiler said, a cleanup from to reflect our current vote-by-mail status, but mainly it is to change the term that we currently have for our military and overseas voters. Currently are listed as long-term absent electors, and so we wanted to change that statute, or change that that title to make it consistent with federal law and with what many of our military and overseas folks are looking for, and what it's called in the Federal Move Act, and just to be consistent there, and also to be a better, more explanatory of who actually these voters are. So replaces long-term absent elector with military overseas elector, and again makes no real no policy changes, just is cleaning up, getting rid of some obsolete language left over from polling place days, and updating the title of our military and overseas electors.
Thank you. Nothing? Kathy?
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, Kathy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We have been supporting the move to electronic ballot return by people overseas for about, this is about the third session now, and it's finally, I think, we're going to get to getting it all cleared up and using the federal language, I believe, is what we've changed it to, military and overseas. So we're very supportive of that and of the technology that's been put in place to simplify the process for people who are overseas in enabling them to vote in a better way. So we're very supportive of this legislation.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
I've asked questions on every bill so far.
I got a brief.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. So at page 2, lines 3 through 5, you've got if they receive an application for an absentee ballot after the fifth day before an election, the county clerk need not mail the ballot but may make it available at the office of the clerk. So we have a 5-day deadline that's being erased from statute, or is it? What is the implication of that? Page 2, lines 3 through 5.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, again, this is part of the confusion when we move from polling places to vote by mail, and this is how we treated absentee voters, and so those requirements are covered in other sections and no longer need to be in this section that now exclusively talks about military and overseas voters.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, panel. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 149, and we're now ready to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 154.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 154 requires organization or entity paying signature gatherers to register with Secretary of State, requires one or more persons representing an organization or entity engaged in signature gathering to complete training established by statute and implemented by Secretary of State, requires a statement clarifying that persons trained have read and understood Oregon law pertaining to signature gathering, requires written affirmation that organization or entity complies with law, makes provisions operative January 1, 2014. There is an emergency clause on the measure. This measure has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and the measure comes to you from the Senate with 16 ayes and 14 no votes. Joe, Gina, Kathy, and Dan.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron. We'll start with Joe Basler, please, and Gina Zedlick.
And Kathy.
Oh, and Kathy. Please stay put.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton, the Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We believe that 154 closes a gap that has been in the initiative process. when an organization or an individual or an entity pays people to gather signatures on election petitions, registration with the Secretary of State should be mandatory, which this bill now requires. The requirement of the training prescribed by the Secretary relative to knowledge about the petition campaign regulations and election laws that need to be taken by the representatives of the sponsoring person of the organization, we believe that helps to ensure compliance. And we believe this is an important piece that actually helps make our initiative process better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. We represent about 24,000 members across the state. We have a very interesting relationship with the ballot initiative process. We have a lot of experience. We've both tried to, we've used volunteers to gather signatures for things like the minimum wage. We've also been, frankly, victimized by ballot measures that have gone after us and that we know where bad, unscrupulous things happen in the gathering of those signatures. But we've also paid to have be part of a coalition to start getting things on the ballot. We in no way have any desire to shut down the process because, frankly, we use it sometimes. But we do believe that everyone who gathers signatures should do it legally and do it in the same level playing field. Right now, signature gatherers have to register, but those companies that train them and set them up and sort of instruct them on how to do it don't have to register. They don't have to say that they are complying with the law. And we have found through signature gatherers and sort of, you know, people running into each other, you know, some of the signature gathering towards the end when the deadline gets closer, they start getting frantic, they start getting worried. Out-of-state corporations sort of come in and start running the signature gathering process, and they'll bring in their training manuals from Colorado or New Mexico and say, here you go, this is how you gather signatures, and those aren't our laws. And so what we want to do is say, you know, if you're here and you're gathering signatures and you're being part of the process, you need to follow our laws, and you need to acknowledge and know what they are. Last time I testified in the Senate in favor, I haven't switched, I'm still in favor, but we also testified with Ted Blazek, who couldn't be here today, but he is submitting written testimony, I don't know if it has come in yet, who is a signature gathering company owner who does comply with the law, and you know, his biggest concern, not to put too many words in his mouth, but you can listen to the tape, was he follows the law and it's unfair for him competition-wise because he follows Oregon's laws and these companies sometimes don't. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Gina Zedlick from the Secretary of State's office, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. I'm here on behalf of the Secretary to testify in support of this bill. We believe that it would give us some more tools and some increased transparency in this process and in enforcement of it. We are in support, and we also, I think that just to point out that part of, there's a general election law that requires anyone who makes an affirmation or takes any oath or anything that's related to election laws is subject to a felony, a potential felony, Class C felony, if they are found to have knowingly lied. So there are some teeth to this. I mean, it really does require a company and to put a person forward who can speak for the company and attest that they are acting in compliance with the law. If it does turn out that there are some, the company ends up in out of compliance with the law, the person would not be on the line unless they knew about that when they signed. So, just to point that out. But
so is that spelled out in the bill? Because we haven't heard from Mr. Meek yet, but we know what his objection is. So if you could kind of speak more to that, I would appreciate it. Because my concern is also that we not unduly punish an innocent actor who in good faith believed that the organization was compliant and for reasons not his or her own fault, that turns out to be incorrect.
Yes, thank you, Chair Garrett. I just got the actual other statute. So in the bill, it's on page 3, line 30. It just says that the person has to affirm that the organization or entity operates in compliance with the law. So that's the affirmation. currently in statute in ORS 267.15, it says a person may not knowingly make a false statement, oath, or affidavit when a statement, oath, or affidavit is required under the election laws. And then later in the penalty provisions, it subjects that particular section to a Class C that may be prosecuted for a Class C felony.
So your position is that this bill kind of, by reference, it incorporates the knowing standard?
Yes, exactly. It definitely incorporates the knowing standard. And
okay.
Yes.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you. Mr. Meek.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Meek. I'm testifying against the provisions of Senate Bill 154 on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon and the Progressive Party of Oregon. I offer this testimony in opposition to the provision of SB 154 that transforms any violation of election law or rules by an initiative, referendum, or recall signature gathering campaign, however minor, into the felony of false swearing, punishable by a fine of $125,000 or 5 years in prison per violation. Let's look at the language of Senate Bill 154. It requires that any, quote, organization or entity that pays money or other valuable consideration to a person for obtaining signatures of electors on a state initiative, referendum, or recall petition, that's not just companies, that's any entity, so that would include the campaign committees, that have any paid signature gatherers working for them in any respect. So it's not just companies, it's the campaigns themselves. That these organizations or entities, quote, shall identify one or more individuals who represent the organization or entity and require that the individual submit a sworn statement affirming that the organization or entity operates in compliance with the law. Now, there was a suggestion by the Secretary of State's witness a few minutes earlier that this doesn't mean very much. It means a lot. The requirement of the sworn statement that the entity operates in compliance with the law, it's not in the past tense. It's not has operated in compliance with the law. It is a pledge that the entity will operate in compliance with the law. It's not just simply making some sort of a statement about what's happened in the past. If it were, then it would be meaningless, because then you could start out the campaign by saying, yes, I affirm that we have operated in compliance with the law, and then if there are violations later, somehow that's not covered by the sworn statement. I believe that the intent of this is to cover violations that occur after the sworn statement is made. And as a result, it imposes liability, a continuing liability, or liability for any continuing or any new violation of law that happens after the sworn statement is made. And making a sworn statement that is false under Oregon election law, under ORS 260.715, is a Class C felony punishable by the amounts that I mentioned earlier.
Can I ask you a question, Dan? I get your point about present and future tense, but how could a person be guilty of a knowingly false affirmation for something that happens in the future?
That's a good question. What does it mean, affirming that the organization or entity operates in compliance with law? And let's say that you make that statement in January, and then in March the government determines that the entity does not or has not operated in compliance with law. Does that mean that you've made, and let's say that the practice that is found to be a violation of law is a practice that the signer knows about. It seems to me that this law then imposes liability upon the signer. I know that my particular practice of XYZ, I knew about that practice, and now the government says that practice violates let's say, a Secretary of State's rule or something that is punishable by currently by a fine of $250. It's not any kind of a criminal penalty, a criminal violation, but that's translated in by this clause into the felony of false swearing. This is really unique. I've never seen this in Oregon law. I've never seen this in the law of any other state, where you take violations that don't amount even to misdemeanors or violations or traffic tickets, purely civil violations of Secretary of State rules, and you convert them into felonies. I'd also like to point out that if this is a good idea for individuals and organizations pursuing ballot measures, then surely it would be a good idea for candidates as well. Vice Chair Hoyle mentioned, for example, that some campaigns have been found in violation of ORSTAR reporting requirements because the system seizes up and they're kicked out of it.
Actually, that's not what I said, but
okay.
Carry on.
Okay. If this concept were applied to candidates, then the failure to file on time a campaign finance transaction would then be converted into a Class C felony, because you would have to sign a paper that in advance says that you're going to operate in compliance with the law, and the law under this statute includes both statutes and rules. I would also point out that under existing law, there's nothing at all similar like this. There are some provisions in ORS 260 and ORS 250 imposing vicarious liability on chief petitioners. In no event does that vicarious liability include criminal offenses. So this would really, this is a unique provision. I believe it means that anyone, including a campaign, anyone involved in a campaign or who is designated as being responsible for a campaign for an initiative referendum or recall seriously risks committing a felony if later the government determines that any of its practices violates any election law or rule. This is an extremely draconian measure, and we strongly oppose it.
Do you happen to have alternative language that you'd propose that would get at the same objective that's less draconian?
Strike it.
No, converting that alternative language, not striking it.
No. Okay. No, I think converting election law violations and rule violations into felonies is not an appropriate purpose to begin with.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 154. Now we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 782.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 782, I'm going to go right to the -A8 amendment. It replaces the measure as written. The -A8 amendment establishes task force on apprenticeship and state contracting. The amendment specifies the membership of the task force. It charges the task force with evaluating and making recommendations concerning apprenticeship utilization standards for state contracting agencies, specifies issues that task force shall consider during its deliberations. Task force will be required to submit an initial report no later than December 1st, 2013, and submit a final report November 1st, 2014 to interim committee on related to workforce development or public contracting. Task force is repealed upon convening of the 2015 regular session of the Legislative Assembly. There is an emergency clause on the amendment. You have a -A8 fiscal statement. The fiscal statement indicates that there is an indeterminate statement because of the unknown funding source for the task force, unknown staffing and support costs, and unknown number of potential meetings. Therefore, the statement is indeterminate.
Mr. Chair, I move the -8 amendments to Senate Bill 782.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves the -A8 amendments to Senate Bill 782. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. 782 is a bill that came over to the House late in the session from the Senate, came to the House Committee on Higher Education Workforce Development, and it was a bill that had to do with setting an apprenticeship standard for all state agency projects. And I would say that there is a widespread agreement that apprenticeship is very important in this state, that it's a really important part of post-secondary education, actually. It's, you know, applied learning, you know, in a very concrete, well, sorry, of course it's concrete. It's a solid program. No, it's very, very important. Some states have actually set standards, minimum standards for their state projects, saying that 10% or more of the employee hours on a state project should be held by apprentices. That was a notion that was interesting to a lot of people. And that was a key part of that bill that came from the Senate. But there were some elements in it that were very controversial and that really surfaced on the House side. House side, we pulled people together and ultimately came to agreement that the best way to handle this would be to set up a task force that would bring all the major players together. And so it has four legislators, two from each party. It has four members from the contractor community, four members from the labor community, one state agency that might use, have construction as part of its purview, and then a local agency as well. This work group, this task force, will ideally come to agreement on some what are actually very thorny issues. But we hope that by hard work we can get there. Perhaps have some initial legislation in place for the 2014 session, and then a more ambitious set of legislation in 2015. So that's what it is. I think all the parties have come to agreement on this. Because it came so late, we had a timing issue on the amendments. That's why it's here before us in rules.
Okay, thanks for that background. Any other discussion on the motion to adopt the A8 amendments? Yes, Mr. Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, just quickly, I'm trying to pace through this and figure out exactly what this task force is to do. There it is. It's line 15 on page 3. Answer my own question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? Is there any objection to adoption of the amendment? Hearing none, motion carries. The bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 782A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 782A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any objection? I'm sorry, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure whether the instructions here are accurate when we get through with the amendment, so please, if I'm exposing my ignorance, my apologies. I'm wondering here, however, if a 10% of the work hours, as is outlined at the beginning here, work under Senate Bill 782A, 10% of the work hours is a realistic number of hours at this stage. Can we even ensure that 10% of the work hours might be available? That the personnel to do that might be available.
Representative, I think that the amendment may replace that provision, but I'd ask Representative Denbro to speak to that.
That's exactly right. That was in the original bill that came over from the Senate. There were questions such as the one you're raising as to whether that's an appropriate standard. That is this Other states have such a standard. Washington started with 10. They're now up to 15. There is a potential path, I believe, to it, but that's obviously something that will have to be hashed out in the task force process. I think Rep. Holvey can probably shed some light on this as well.
Thanks. Mr. Chair.
Please.
10% is well within the standards of most apprenticeship programs, and I speak to this because I spent 10 years chairing a joint apprenticeship training committee and have worked on this particular issue since 2005 when Dan Gardner was trying to get this done, actually in 2003, and I picked it up from him. 10% is actually a much lower number than most of the standards that are required under apprenticeship agreements with their employers. And ODOT currently has a standard in place. It's had a standard in place for 3 or 4 years, I believe, of 10%, and they're doing above that from the reports that I've received from them on their projects across the state. There is potential that, you know, some people say that apprentices may not be available in certain areas, but in today's construction world, most companies travel all over the state and have a workforce that also travels, and we're hoping that with some of the other bills that are in there that we're going to be trying to get some more apprentices into the programs. But I think the work group's going to look at this issue and come back with recommendations.
Thank
and
you.
Certainly we want to make sure it's a doable program.
Does that address your question, Representative?
I think so.
Okay.
I think it's somewhat different in my world than it may be in downtown Portland or even perhaps downtown Salem, you know, sort of thing.
Downtown Portland is different from everywhere else I know.
Mr. Chair, can I just say, actually, we've lined that out as one of the things to be looked at in the task force, that there might well be geographical variations for this kind of thing.
And please don't understand that I'm not opposed to apprenticeship programs. I taught in high school that had an extremely active apprenticeship programs and was you know, that was very successful, and I saw some wonderful things come out of that, even though that's been 2-3 years ago. So I'm supportive of the idea and the concept. I'm really worried about something you're already addressing, so I'll be quiet.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, me crazy. Thank you, Representative. Is there further discussion on the motion to refer to Ways and Means? Is there any objection? Hearing none. Motion carries. Bill is referred. Close the work session on Senate Bill 782. And we're ready to open a work session on Senate Bill 146.
And members, Senate Bill 146 is the measure that revises and realigns statutory language relating to qualification and maintenance of minor political party.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 146 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair, I move Senate Bill 146 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to be ultimately cautious. In one of these bills, we had an issue involving the repeal of one statute.
That was 145.
I just want to make certain.
We will not be moving that bill.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'm happy with this one.
So we have a motion 146. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, motion carries. And I'm just going to carry it.
But the Secretary of State may also, somebody on the committee.
Representative Barnhart, would you carry the bill?
Sure.
Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 146. Open this work session on Senate Bill 147.
And members of the committee, Senate Bill 147 was the measure that specifies time frame for filing candidate portrait and statement in voter's pamphlet and requires statement be filed electronically.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 147 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 147 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Representative Hoyle, would you love to carry that bill?
Sure.
Thank you. close the work session on Senate Bill 147. Open work session on Senate Bill 148.
And members of the committee, Senate Bill 148 was the measure that requires chief petitioner to ensure criminal records check is conducted by paid signature gatherer applicant. It allows for the district attorney or city attorney to correct clerical errors in ballot title for city or county measure and creates whistleblower protection for a person paid to obtain signatures on petition for initiative, referendum, recall, or prospective petition for state measure.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 148 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair, I move Senate Bill 148 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I've been asked for a roll call vote on that, so let's have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Dembrough.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Kennemer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
No.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 148 is moved to the floor. Representative Holby, would you carry that?
Is it controversial? certainly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen, would you carry that bill?
If you're satisfied with 25 no words, yeah.
Representative Jensen will carry that bill.
What's the scare today? It's 32.
Close the work session. Close the work session on Senate Bill 148.
That's good move.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 149.
And members of the committee, Senate Bill 149 was the measure that updates laws related to ballots for absent electors and adjusts terminology related to military overseas electors.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. I'll carry that one. We're not doing 154 there. I'm going to, what did we just do?
149.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 149. I'm going to carry over the work session on Senate 154 so we can have a little more discussion of that.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 145, I understand Representative Hicks is requesting.
Yes, the committee is.
I think.
I missed the discussion of that.
I think, Mr. Chair, there were several of us who were concerned about the provision that repeals a particular statute.
Thank you. We'll carry over the work session on Senate 145.
So we can open the work session.
We already have the hearing on.
We have the hearing on.
Okay, so we will carry over the work session on House Bill 3537.
And that's it.
And that concludes our business.
What was the yours? 35, did we move that? Mm-hmm.
Did we move 35?
It was the HCR.
The very beginning.
Should we suspend the rules to have people vote that weren't here?
Oh, yeah, like me.
Good.
Representative Dembrough.
Would somebody like to do that? That'd be great.
I'd like to make a motion. Or do you want to do that? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move that the rules be suspended and that you...
Representative Garrett and Representative Dembrough.
Representative Garrett and Representative Dembrough be allowed to vote on HCR 35.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Berger moves rules be suspended so that Representative Dembrough and myself to vote on HCR 35. Is there any objection? Hearing none. So order. Representative Dembrough, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dembrough votes aye. Chair votes aye. Close the work session on HCR 35.
And that's it.
3537. Did we vote on that?
We didn't do that.
We didn't move it.
Mr. Chair, today we only did a public hearing on House Bill 3537. We did not have the fiscal impact statement to do the work session on it yet.
Thank you.
Vote for the business committee adjourned.